So at the beginning of the year, I got an email from Tova. Many of you were here and met her, and she sends out this newsletter for all of the Suzuki Roshi lineage groups. And she said she had heard from somebody else that they had chosen a word to practice with for the year. And so first of all, I have to say I'm not a big fan of New Year's resolutions, because it's kind of like setting me up for failure, and I like to set myself up and everyone for success. So I'm not making a New Year's resolution, but it did make me think about, well, what word do I want to practice with, at least for a while? And at first, the word inclusiveness came to me. And then I thought about it more, and I realized that really what matters to me and what has mattered probably all my life is connection. And inclusiveness, I think, is included in that. At least I hope it is. So I also chose that word because you may be familiar with what's called the three marks of existence, or the three marks. Sometimes it's called the three marks of a true Buddhist teaching. I remember Thich Nhat Hanh saying that. And those are the everything that is conditioned, that's us and everything else, is subject to suffering, that there is no separately abiding self, and everything is impermanent. So there's no separation. For me, that's really the antidote, if you will, to suffering, when you can feel that and experience that. And I think I find connection, as I've been sitting with that word, I've realized that's really like the positive way to say that, say no separate self. It's also an aspirational way. You know, I want to be in connection. I am in connection, and I want to feel that connection. Thank you. So last week, Misha talked and we talked together about what it is that's getting us to practice. Why do we practice? And for me, one of the important parts of practice, we might call it forms. The way we do things, that we have a service, that we dress in a certain way, sit in a certain way. But for tonight, I want to call it ritual. And partly I will credit Elisa with this, because she and I had a conversation not too long ago about what draws us. Why is it some people are drawn to ritual and other people, doesn't do much for me. And I had told Elisa, and you've probably heard me say, that in my household growing up, there was no, religion was not allowed, let's say. And spirituality was frowned upon. And I said, well, but we had a lot of rituals. And Elisa said, were they rituals or were they traditions? And then we thought about that together a little bit. And what is it that makes something that you do over and over, what makes it a ritual? And I think partly it's the element of the sacred. It feels like it's touching something beyond just little old me and you, that it has a root, I think, in belief and faith that there's something effective in it. And it also, I think, is about connection, connecting through time and space to the past, to the present, and on into the future. And I read, and I've never been able to find this again, so if this is not true, it still makes sense to me. I read that one of the roots of the word ritual has to do with thread. And it is a thread. As I say, whether that's really true or not, it is a thread from past to present. present across time, from us to all of the Suzuki Roshi lineages this week who are bowing as we bow and sitting as we sit. So I meant to bring it tonight, but Elisa loaned me a book about ritual. I've gotten as far as the introduction, which was written by an anthropologist and somebody I've heard speak, unfortunately passed away a few years ago, Angelus Arian. And she cites another anthropologist who talks about the elements of ritual. And if you'll bear with me, I'm just going to list them. These are ceremonies that commemorate important events in our lives. And one of the things, maybe one of the reasons I'm drawn to ritual, is that there's precious little in our lives anymore that we really commemorate. And these transitions are really life-changing. First, of course, is birth, you know, and so the newness of things, birth, entry, something like going to school for the first time, going to college, or going back to college, making contact with others, moving out. Initiation, of course, is a big one, and it's really too bad we kind of skip that in a way, that our culture has lost that. Initiation means, or brings with it, the willingness to learn something new, and also to be tested on it. And there won't be a test tonight, I promise. Marriage, emergence, or just whatever is bringing together, even like something like a new house can be in that category. The capacity for commitment and integration, for bringing together opposites. There's ceremony in demonstrating the ability to facilitate or heal or teach or guide. Attainment is another transition, which marks inner contentment and modeling a skill or talent, like graduation, right? And death. And death doesn't literally, it isn't always literally death. There's also big losses, a loss of relationship, loss of a dream or a vision, loss of a job. But it means letting go and moving on or moving out towards something new. So I list all of this because I want to, or I have been thinking about it in terms of the main ceremony that we do it together on Monday night and on Saturdays. Maybe you do it at home, that's Sazen. And that may not seem like a ceremony, but think about the elements of how we do it. Our practice is to bow to our cushion, to bow to everybody who is there, then to sit down, take a particular posture. It's not just any posture, and also to sit still, to find a stable position and sit still. So I think this covers many of the categories that the anthropologist noted. When we bow to our cushion, first of all, we're thanking what has been supporting us and continues to support us. And right now in this moment will support us. So in a way we're acknowledging, I'm here. My cushion, you're here, thank you. And it's the birth, if you will, of each moment. And by remaining present, or, you know, we're not present all the time, but when we return to the present in our meditation, then we are again attentive to the newness of the moment. So we enter into this ceremony together. We make contact with others. We bow to everybody who's here. Each time we sit, if we're faithful to the practice of having an open mind and allowing the mind to reveal itself, and I think that's really what our practice is about, over and over, the mind revealing itself to itself, then we are initiated over and over again. Something new, something that we might not really be tested on, but we are learning from it, little by little. And practicing together or practicing on our own, this increases our ability to facilitate and heal this transition, if you will, or transformation of demonstrating what we do. I think there's another aspect of ceremony that he doesn't list, and that's enactment. Every time we sit down, we're taking the posture that Shakyamuni took. It's not just any old posture. And even if we sit in a chair, we're still bringing that into our awareness, into our body. Misha, you said to me once years ago, I was very upset because I had read, according to this one Southeast Asian Buddhist, that the only way to awaken is in the full lotus. And I said, I can't do that. And you said, and you've told me you don't remember this, but that's the best things we say are what we don't remember. Misha said to me, what makes you think the full lotus is in your legs? You know, we embody it, even if we can't make our body take that position. Whatever we're doing, it's with intention. It is embodied, and it's embodying what the Buddha did, sitting there, sitting still, despite all of the cold and the whatever creatures were around bothering him. He sat still. It also, as I say, it's a posture that is taken over and over again. If you go to any Zen practice place here or in Japan, and now there are places in South America and Europe, wherever you go, you see this ceremony, you see this posture. We're enacting this together. But I have to say, this ceremony is only effective if you keep in mind Suzuki Roshi's admonition to have no thought of attainment. Even though we're trying to be still, or we're trying to be enlightened, or whatever it is, we also just have to let that all go and just sit. Just sit. So one of the aspects of Zazen that can be most troublesome and sometimes controversial is this direction to sit still. So at first, I have to say, when I first started to practice, this was a very helpful instruction, because keeping still, it's part of this initiation aspect, if you will, this learning something new, because this is the way we watch ourselves, we watch our body, we watch our mind. And it's part and parcel of meeting the moment. How else do you meet the moment except with your breath and your posture? And this is what we're watching. On the other hand, I remember Darlene Cohn instructing us on Zazen, saying, there's no such thing as not moving. If you sit still, well, first of all, you're breathing, that's moving. There are, I noticed today as I was sitting, my eye is doing this little bit of fluttering. That's moving, our body moves. Sometimes involuntary, sometimes voluntarily. So there's always movement, but can we be aware of it? And being that aware, not moving, you also notice the movement that's going on. But as I've gotten older, I find that this instruction, it's really become more of a hindrance and even a danger to well-being, because according to my surgeon, I'm not supposed to sit for longer than 20 minutes, so I may have to get up at some point. And if I do, I pay for it by being in pain, you know, for several hours. That's not a good instruction all the time. Or if you're sitting and you're young and you're healthy, you may find something is hurting. The way that I learned to work with that is to ask myself or notice it three times. You know, can I let it go? And if it keeps coming back and it's back the third time, it's probably time to move. And Rick had the experience of being told the first time that he was given Zazen instruction at Tassajara not to move. Nobody checked his posture. He was just told, don't move. And he wasn't in a good posture. And I think you were hobbling around for most of the day after that. So the most important thing is this stable posture. I love the way Thich Nhat Hanh says it. He says, we don't teach, in his tradition, we don't teach the lotus position. We teach the chrysanthemum position. And the chrysanthemum position is any position you can hold with stability for half an hour. Now, I have to say, right now, my chrysanthemum position is lying down. And you would think, oh, that's easy. It isn't. Every posture we take, standing, sitting, or lying down, there is some challenge. So I was recently reminded, I've been reading Mel Weitzman's book, and he mentions that Suzuki Roshi had said, don't move for your own convenience. And that's kind of been a koan for me past couple of weeks. When do I move for my convenience? You know, I wiggle my toes. Is that really because something is hurting? No, I'm lying down. There's no reason to wiggle my toes. So am I bored? Am I distracted? What's that about? You know, or I just kind of change my hand position. Just why? Because it's for my convenience, not because there's anything that's harmful there. So it's really been interesting to watch. Even lying down, it is difficult to hold still. And maybe because I'm lying down and in some senses it's easier, it's also harder. So there are other rituals we do, many. One that I particularly love is the robe chant. We don't do that on Monday nights, but we do it on Saturdays. And for those of you who don't know, it's a tradition going back to Dogen's time, to the 13th century. It was something that he observed when he went to China, that the monks put their robes on their head. And then they said this verse, which translates roughly to great robe of liberation, field, and there is a rice field that we sow on the Rakusu. That's another story. I'll tell that story another time. Field far beyond form and emptiness. You know, we chant about form and emptiness in the Heart Sutra. This is even going beyond that. So if you don't understand the Heart Sutra, that's okay. This is even more not to understand. Field far beyond form and emptiness, wearing the Tathagata's teaching, and all of you, every time you sit down, whether you have a rakusu or not, you sit down and you are putting this on, the Tathagata's teaching. Just by assuming an intentional posture, that's your mind robe. And what is that robe for? It's to awaken, to save, to free, to be with all beings. We do this for all beings. So a while ago, I was sitting with another group and they were doing the robe chant, and there was somebody in the group who held his rakusu but did not put it on his head. And it was my reaction was really interesting. I kind of felt disappointed. I don't know why I felt that. It was just like, I think it had something to do with the connection, if you will, that was not being made between past, present, future. The connection through the ritual, that it was just, oh, sort of something to, you know, chant and get over with and put it on and get down to what he was going to do, which was to sit. So, as I say, I was just very curious about my reaction to that and what that was. So recently, I read another Zen practitioner sent around an article that had been in the New York Times about a Jewish ritual, which goes back to probably around the 3rd century BCE. And I was just moved by reading this, let alone doing it. And I don't know whether this might have some effect on you, but it did on me. And this is something that is codified in one of what's called the Mishnah. What's the Mishnah? It's a collection of writings after the Torah, right? Okay, so here's what it instructs in this text. Several times each year, hundreds of thousands of Jews would go to Jerusalem. They would climb the steps of the Temple Mount and enter its enormous plaza, turning to the right, circling counterclockwise. Meanwhile, the brokenhearted, the mourners, and here I would also include the lonely and the sick, would do the same thing, but they would turn to the left and circle in the opposite direction. So if you imagine this in a huge, large square, and people are circling, one to the right, one to the left. And on this side are the people who are lonely or sick, or even the people who have been ostracized from the community. They come too, and they're on the left. And each person who encountered someone in pain would look into that person's eyes and inquire, "What happened to you? Why does your heart ache?" "My father died," a person might say. "There are so many things I never got to say to him." Or perhaps, "My partner left. I was blindsided." This part isn't in the text, by the way. This is the interpolation of the person writing. Or, "My child is sick. We're awaiting the test results." This part is in the text. Those who walked from the right would offer a blessing. "May the Holy One comfort you," they would say. "You were not alone." And then they would continue to walk until the next person approached. This timeless wisdom speaks to what it means to be human in a world of pain. This year, you walk the path of the anguished. Perhaps next year, it will be me. I hold your broken heart, knowing that one day, you will hold mine. So as I say, I felt it just from reading it. So the title of this article in the Times, and if anybody wants to read the whole thing, I can send you the link. But I love this. The title of the article is "Train Yourself to Always Show Up." And that's what we're doing also. I remember Roshi Joan has said that she thinks that the name of her temple at Upaya, that it shouldn't, whatever their Japanese name, she wants over the door it to say, "Just show up." So this aspect of ritual, of the forms that we observe, if you want to call them that, this is essential for me. And it might not be what rocks your boat, but it has rocked mine for a while. It connects me to something ancient, It's not just about me and my preferences and what I like to do. It is about ancient twisted karma. And it's also about my faith in transforming it through the three treasures, through taking refuge in the Buddha, who symbolizes the oneness of reality, awakened reality, refuge in the Dharma, which symbolizes the diversity of reality, and refuge in the Sangha, symbolizing interconnectedness of oneness and diversity. And that's realized at the end on Mondays when we say this ancient Sanskrit chant, the Tisarana, the three treasures, taking refuge. So I think I'll stop there. And if there are any questions or comments, particularly if there's anything you're practicing with, or any particular form or ritual that affects you, I think others would love to hear it. And I will.